From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On the show today, coming to terms with the complicated history of slavery in Boston.
Peter Faneuil indeed was a slave trader. The proceeds that were dedicated to the city to construct Faneuil Hall were derived from the sale of an unnamed slave boy.
So how should the city best acknowledge and remember that dark past? Also today, did the Boston School Committee violate state law by voting on former Superintendent Tommy Chang's departure deal behind closed doors? And Mark Zuckerberg gets more specific about what kinds of speech Facebook will censor, but is he walking a dangerous line?
The principles that we have on what we remove from the service are, if it's going to result in real harm, real physical harm, or if you're attacking individuals, then that content shouldn't be on the platform.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. What's the best way to memorialize the complete history of Faneuil Hall? You may know that it's one of Boston's major attractions. It gets about 20 million visitors every year. It's also obviously named after 18th century merchant Peter Faneuil. You may also know that it's called the Cradle of Liberty because revolutionary patriots met at the hall to organize against the British, and that later Faneuil Hall also drew the likes of Susan B. Anthony, who argued for suffrage, and Frederick Douglass, even, who in 1849 thundered from Faneuil Hall, quote, "With 18 millions of free men standing upon the quivering hearts of 3 million slaves, my sympathies, of course, must be with the oppressed. I am among them, and you are treading them beneath your feet." And yet, did you know that Peter Faneuil himself made his wealth trading enslaved people? That there was a slave market at Merchants Row right next to Faneuil Hall? Where are the markers for this part of Faneuil Hall's history? How should it be memorialized? Well, today, we want to hear a couple of different perspectives on that very important question. And joining us now to talk through it is Kevin Peterson. He's the executive director of the New Democracy Coalition and a senior fellow at the Center for Collaborative Leadership at UMass Boston. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you.
Yeah.
Also with us is Stephen Locke. He's one of Boston's 2018 Artists in Residence. He's also a professor at Mass Art. Stephen Locke, welcome to you as well.
Meghna, it's good to be with you. Kevin, it's good to be with you,
hey,
too.
Xavier.
And listeners, I want to ask you, how do you think it's best to memorialize, to honor, to recognize this complex history of what happened at the ground where Faneuil Hall stands? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Now, Kevin and Stephen, before I sort of get to the ideas that you have on how to memorialize this, I wanted to actually start with a more general question for both of you. When you go to Faneuil Hall today and you walk about the buildings and the site there, what do you see? What do you feel? What is the experience like for you?
I think, well, for me, Kevin, I don't see myself, quite frankly. I grew up in a city like Boston, Philadelphia, so we have Independence Hall. So I have a sense of civic space, particularly old civic space, and have a sense of, around how that space is organized. And when I go to the Faneuil Hall Marketplace area, although I know the history, I don't see myself represented in any significant way. And that's a problem not only for my generation, but for generations that will come, of Bostonians in particular, but also the 20 million people who come through the marketplace each year. They don't see Boston's complete history, and that's problematic.
Mm. And Stephen, what about you?
I see this really vibrant area that's filled with commerce and tourism and students, all sorts of people engaged with the history of Boston, the Freedom Trail. I see the Rangers. I see all that stuff. But also, as an artist, I'm trained to notice what's missing.
Right.
And I also notice what's present. We memorialize a lot of things in that area of the city. And the thing that we do not memorialize by choice, not by circumstance, but by choice, we do not memorialize the people who built that building.
Mm-hmm.
And so I notice that. I notice all the other stuff, too. It's a really vibrant, exciting place. It's a beautiful part of the city.
Right.
But it's also a slave market.
Exactly. So that's the thing. Like when your eyes are opened to the truth, the full truth of the history of Faneuil Hall, the land, the building, Peter Faneuil himself, the kind of painful irony that we see a lot of commerce there, and yet it was built upon the commerce of this buying and selling of African lives. It's just, it's amazing that there isn't any recognition, really, that I can think of right now, of that fact at the site right now.
There's one tiny recognition. There's a plaque on the side of Faneuil Hall that says, still in use by a free people. And that notion that it's a free people that use Faneuil Hall, that's really the only sort of nod to its history.
And then what's so difficult about the contradiction of the space as it's now composed is that there are so many wonderful things that have gone on that have been about liberty. Mm-hmm. We remember Crispus Attucks, for example, as being probably the first person to die in what's known as the Revolutionary War.
Killed
in the Boston Massacre. Only two blocks away from Faneuil Hall. He was so honored and revered by by the city's fathers that his body was laid in state where? At Faneuil Hall for 3 days. So there are a lot of positive things that we can focus on in a ground that is unfortunately not so hallowed and that's stained by the blood of slaves.
Yeah. So then this question, how do we as a city acknowledge that history? You guys have different ideas about that. So let me, Kevin, or maybe some overlapping ideas.
Yeah.
But I want to get into the specifics. So Kevin, you've been advocating to rename Faneuil Hall.
I've suggested in the spirit of what's been happening around the country, Confederate monuments have been coming down across the South. Some of our major universities, even in the Northeast, Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, have repurposed and renamed edifices that are on that campus because they're connected to slavery. I say symbolically we rename Faneuil Hall. We don't name every edifice that's named after a slaveholder who may be connected to Boston. That would be exhaustive and redundant. It would cost a lot of money. But we focus on a place like Faneuil Hall, which has a sort of mixed history, but one that's really connected to the agony of people being enslaved. So we focus on Faneuil Hall, renaming it, and having it always stand as an opportunity for conversations around reconciliation and around re-engaging city citizens across the city.
Renaming
in conversation.
It to what?
Crispus Attucks Hall is I think would be a fitting place because of Mr. Hall's connection. I mean, Crispus Attucks' connection to that geographical space.
Yeah. And Stephen Luck, you're an artist in residence for the city of Boston, professor
right.
of mass art.
Right.
You've got a different idea.
Well, you know, I think that it's really hard to live with history. And I think history is not black, it's not white, it's not colonial, it's just history. And the problem is that one history has been privileged over another. And so to rename Faneuil Hall is one way to deal with history. But I don't want to let Peter Faneuil or Andrew Faneuil off the hook. I want everyone who comes to Boston to know that those people were slavers. And I want people to know that the cradle of liberty was built by slavers. Mm. So I understand the wound that people experience when they're there. As an artist, I'm taught to produce objects that deal with history. And over the course of my career, my work has dealt with loss and absence and things like that. So I propose building a plate, just a simple bronze plate that's roughly the size of a traditional auction block. Make it in bronze because that is the language of memorial architecture down there.
Mm-hmm.
Have it set into the hardscape so it wouldn't protrude. It would actually just be the footprint of an auction block. In raised lettering, it will have a map of the triangular trade, which will show where people came from, the transfer of goods and people. And it will be titled the Auction Block Memorial, a site dedicated to those African Americans whose kidnapping and enslavement financed the building of Faneuil Hall. Because that's the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion that this thing would be present in the hardscape and people could walk on it or avoid it, like we do all history, right? But it would be present, it'd be physically present, and it would be heated to the temperature of a human body. So when you touch it, it would evoke the presence of those people who are lost. And I agree with Kevin about Crispus Attucks. Crispus Attucks deserves a fitting memorial for his sacrifice to this nation. Mm. And he does not have one.
Mm. So I want to know just what you guys think of each other's ideas, because they're two different takes. Again, they're not mutually exclusive, but they're two different takes on this question of memorialization. And so Kevin, when you hear of Stephen's idea for this at grade level memorial that would evoke the auction block, what do you think?
I think it's a lovely idea, and one doesn't cancel out the others, as you said. I think that. We can walk and chew gum at the same time,
right.
Even historically. I think that it's problematic for many Bostonians of color who now know the history or coming to know the history in a fuller light over the last year or year and a half. So, it really hurts their heart that there is this edifice that that is iconic but represents something that is very, very painful. And some folks have said to me that it would be unconscionable for an edifice that represented the success of a German traitor under Hitler, who was a supporter, to have that in Brookline or a majority Jewish community, for example. It would be painful for someone in the East Boston, where there was historically an Italian community, to have someone who was a supporter of Mussolini, for example, in their community. So there, what I'm hoping that folks should understand, not Mr. Locke, I think he's clear in terms of his sympathy, but I would hope that others who are not of color, what they would try to understand is that this edifice is painful. Mm. And that we don't erase history by assigning a new utility to the building. We're adding to the, in some ways, the painfully rich history, because blacks had a important role over in the Faneuil Hall area. And I just wanted to say something else. Not only were the slaves sold at Merchants Row, but the merchandise, the cotton that came to Merchants Row came from the South. So you also have this other layer of misery and other aspects of slavery that when black people look at that building and reminisce it in its fullness, they have to be a little hurt.
So I want to come back to – you brought up a couple of really, really important points. I want to come back to them in a second. But I did promise Stephen a chance to respond to what Kevin's idea of changing the name of Faneuil Hall entirely.
Well, you know, I understand the desire to do that, and I understand the logic behind it. I don't agree, and I love the fact that, you know, we don't have this sort of monolithic idea about black people that they all agree on the same thing, that, you know, there's all different kinds of thoughts about history. I think it's very hard to deal with America as a black person, and Faneuil Hall is just a subset of that. Mm-hmm. Like, every time I put on a cotton shirt, I think mm-hmm. about my family. Mm-hmm. So that history is part of the weight that black people have to bear. What I want to have happen is I want to produce an object that's going to share that burden on the people who created it. Because we always talk about slavery, but we never talk about the people who enslaved people. Like, slavery just like happened. Like, oh, there were all these slaves. Well, where'd they come from? Like, they were enslaved. People were, you know how hard it is to pick cotton? Mm-hmm. It is so hard to pick cotton that you have to drag people from Africa in chains and make them do it. That's how hard it is to pick cotton. And that is the foundational crop of this country. And understanding that in relationship, that's why it's an auction block. Mm. Because the auction block is the site in black American life where people were transformed from subjects into objects.
Yeah.
Where they were turned from humans into slaves.
So I just want to jump in here and remind listeners that we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And we're talking about how to memorialize, how to best memorialize the truly complex history of Faneuil Hall, the land that it sits on, the man that it's currently named after, given the complex history of the enslavement of people, of colonial New England, of colonial Boston, and of modern-day Boston as well. So I'd love to hear your thoughts, right? 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Now, you know, in the several years now that we've been having this conversation about accurate memorialization of complex history,
right,
it has been hard not to for the conversation to end up in a really reductive place. So I'm going to try hard to avoid that.
Okay.
But at the same time, you know, there are a lot of people out there who, upon hearing, for example, the idea of a name change, might say, I understand that we need to raise up the awareness and the acceptance and the engagement of this history that we haven't confronted so far as a community. But what's your response to folks who say that might privilege, you know, that part of American history over what we're privileging now, that it's sort of like focusing on one area versus the other, that it's a zero-sum game, essentially.
Kind of like reverse discrimination or something like that?
I don't
historical?
Know. I think some people might. I mean, that's essentially what they're asking when they say, aren't you erasing history,
right? If they would put it that way, as you put it, I would say, no, it's affirmative history. We're raising up history that's been suppressed. I'm stunned almost daily now about how people say that, oh, if you change the name, you're erasing history. Well, no. Well, what about the history of all those people whose identity, whose livelihood, whose culture, whose literature has been suppressed and reduced to insignificance in this city? You know, there is this phrase around, and I don't mean to go on too long, but there's this phrase about, you know, not being able to heal the present without referencing the history. Late last year, we read through an agonizing series of articles in the Boston Globe, and we wonder why we are where we are as a city in terms of how as black people are treated. That's the blunt assessment of it. Well, I think part of that is because we haven't really addressed some of the deep wounds and some of the suppressed narratives of our history, where black people were relegated to in slavery in this city, but also relegated to second-class citizens, pushed from Beacon Hill up to currently Mattapan,
right.
Forced migration in terms of housing plan. There's a problem in the city of Boston. You got to get to that problem, and I think one way is to use the metaphor of history.
You know, I just want to jump in here for a second, because also Peter Faneuil presents kind of an interesting quandary here, because he's not, you know, one of the pantheon of the founding fathers,
right?
I mean, he was a
merchant.
He was a merchant, a French Huguenot. I get it. Like, his own family history was one of fleeing persecution in Europe, but
probably like a Donald Trump of his day.
But you know, so it's not.
I can't believe you went there.
It's like John Adams Hall that we're talking about here.
But you know, Magna, this is the thing. Like, people are not all good or all bad.
That's right.
And there's a way in which the narrative that has been currently put forward about Peter Faneuil Hall is that he's all good. He's benevolent. He's the jolly bachelor, like all that sort of stuff. The truth of the matter is that he trafficked in human beings. And because he trafficked in human beings and made an enormous fortune doing it, he was able to give a gift to the city. That gift is tainted with the blood of enslaved people. So we have to deal with that. How we deal with that is at issue, but we have to deal with that. And I agree with this whole idea. When we were selected as a Boston artist in residence, we were told to look at the city through a lens of resilience and racial equity,
mm-hmm.
right? If we don't look at Boston's history of enslavement, we can't go forward.
Yeah.
We have to look at this in its context.
Well, so let me just turn back to Kevin here for a second. I'm wondering what you think of the idea of, given what Stephen just said, it made me wonder, preserving the name of Faneuil Hall, but at the same time, whether it's through a memorial like the one Stephen's proposing or another one, have also front and center a very visual, impactful, engaging reminder that this too is a major part of the meaning of the word Faneuil, the enslavement of people.
Right.
So that it's almost a confrontational memorial. Not just, you know, one in name only.
I mean, I don't disagree with that. I neither do I disagree with naming City Hall structure, Crispus Attucks Hall, which has no name right now.
Right.
Or naming, another suggestion was the State House, the old State House, yeah. where Crispus Attucks was murdered, as Crispus Attucks Plaza.
Yeah.
So I'm not opposed to those other ideas. What I am most in favor of is lifting the historical narrative of Boston in such a way that we're able to grapple with our racial problems.
Yeah.
The evidence is just so clear. I mentioned the Boston Globe series. That is not disconnected with the past. If we can find some narratives, some tropes, some metaphors to lift up in substantive ways, such as changing the name of Faneuil Hall to Crispus Attucks Hall, then we'll all be a better Boston for generations to come.
Let's take
and while this idea might be radical, it might be the best medicine for us.
We've known a little bit about radicalism here, too. So I think we should talk about radical ideas. I like
right.
it. Let's take a couple calls here. Beth is calling from Natick. You're on the air, Beth.
Yes, hi. I am calling as a historian by training and background. And I really do feel that it's important to lay these stories, these histories, these parts of the same person or the same experience side by side, and to really add to rather than banish people from our history, and to add the story of Peter Faneuil's other side, because I feel concerned if we marginalize people who rightly, you know, did horrible, terrible things, but if we just eliminate them from the story, it gives us a sense that people, as your guest said, who have both good and bad in them, can do things like this. Someone who is very self-serving can also be selfless in some ways, and we need to be able to hold that, that we're all capable of both wonderful and terrible acts. And so I feel like contextualization is the way to go rather than elimination.
Beth, thank you. I'm going to jump in. Thank you so much for your call. And Stephen and Kevin, you want to respond?
I really agree with that. And I think that there's, in this moment when we're starting to look at the way we memorialize things through the built form, this discussion is coming at the same time we're looking at Confederate monuments, mm-hmm. right? And so there's a way in which sometimes people are conflating Faneuil Hall with a Confederate monument.
That's right.
And there's a difference there that Peter Faneuil actually built Faneuil Hall, and it was extant while he was alive, right? Those Confederate monuments, as everybody knows, were built in response to the Civil Rights era. They were built by white citizens' councils. They were built as mustering places for the Klan. And so those things, when they come down, I don't lose any sleep about it. I actually think that maybe they should stay up. And what we should do is make a plaque large enough to be seen from space that says, this object was put here by white supremacists to intimidate black citizens. Hmm. It stands here today as a monument to our shame. So I am all for contextualization. Ooh, I can't even say that today. I'm all for context, but I'm also very much interested in understanding how artists connect with municipal spaces and respond to history through the built form.
Kevin?
Well, I think that I'm repeating myself a little bit. It's important to raise up narratives that counter longstanding narratives in order for us to move forward. That's what all this is about. Not about erasing history, but it's about challenging ourselves and challenging another generation of Bostonians to confront the issue of racism and how important it is for us to wrestle with it, struggle with it, confront each of with it in order to make progress. Otherwise, I'm afraid that we won't. I'm not sure if Boston is racially better now in 2018 than it was in 1973 during the height of the busing. All indications suggest that it's not. So how do you get from one place to the other is the argument I'm putting on the table. I'm all for memorials, but I'm very much committed to raising important, critical, civic issues that go to the heart of the matter. And what goes to the heart of the matter in Boston, then the issue of liberty and freedom and democracy. We don't grapple with a place like Faneuil Hall, which is actually a patina of racism, a patina of slavery, a patina, mm-hmm. Blood of black people are bounded in the ground. So how do you get to talking about democracy in 2000?
I really, really think you get to it through the creation of images and objects. I really do believe this because you think about Michelle Obama. When she got so much heat for saying, I live in a house that was built by slaves.
Yeah.
So, like, almost every black person I know knew that. Like, I knew that the White House was built by slaves. But there's all these other people who did not know that, and they were so hurt that she brought that up. How could she say that? That's the truth. And there's a whole bunch of people who do not want to live with the truth.
Yeah.
And it's my job.
Yeah, I don't think we disagree, yeah.
And it's my job as someone who makes things. I can make you pay attention, and I can make you pay attention to the truth. And I think the hard thing for a lot of people is the truth is not comfortable. The truth does not privilege anyone. The truth is simply the truth. And I understand what you're saying about the patina of racism in this city. I think that there's a way in which having artists interact with the apparatus of the city through a lens of
I agree with that. Yeah.
Has exposed a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I hate to say this, but we are flat out of time.
We just started.
I know. This is the longest segment of the show today.
You do this to me every time I'm on this show.
And we've got tons of callers. I'm so sorry I can't get to you. Call earlier next time.
Call Meghna at home.
I don't have a landline, so sorry. You can't call me at home. But you know what I want to do? I want to actually end with the quotation that I started off with because I think Frederick Douglass, brilliantly in 1849, at Faneuil Hall really nails it when he said, with 18 million then of free men, meaning free white men, standing upon the quivering hearts of 3 million slaves, my sympathies, of course, must be with the oppressed. I am among them, and you are treading them beneath your feet.
Right.
Whether we knew it or not, today, standing on the ground of Faneuil Hall. So,
absolutely.
Frederick Douglass there. Kevin Peterson, founder and executive director of the New Democracy Coalition, thank you so much for joining
us. You're welcome. Glad to be here.
And Stephen Locke, artist in residence for the city of Boston and a professor at Mass Art. Thank you as well.
Thank you, Meghna. Thank you, Kevin.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 4 years ago, Boston Public Schools began using a computerized school assignment system. The idea was that the algorithm would reduce segregation in the city's school system and give more minority students access to higher quality schools. But a report released earlier this week finds that that did not happen. Dan O'Brien is the lead author of that report, and he joins us now. He's an associate professor at Northeastern University and co-director of the Boston Area Research Initiative. Dan O'Brien, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hey, thanks for having me, Meghna.
Also with us is Kevin Murray. He's a parent with the organization Quality Education for Every Student, or QUEST. Kevin Murray, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
All right. So, Dan, let me just start with you. What exactly did your study find about whether or not the algorithm was providing greater access to students in Boston public schools?
Simply put, the algorithm in the system didn't really improve equity. Unfortunately, it maintained a lot of the inequities that existed under the previous system. And unfortunately, that means that many of our most disadvantaged students, more disenfranchised populations, didn't quite have as much access as their peers.
I mean, the numbers are actually pretty shocking, I have to say. From what I see here in the report, you found that 80% of kindergartens, 80% of kindergarten students in Charlestown, Back Bay, Beacon Hill, and Central Boston, so i.e. the whitest neighborhoods in the city, who enroll in the city school system, attended a high-quality school, 80% of those kindergartners. But 5% of kindergartners in Mattapan attended a high-quality school. Were you surprised by that disparity?
Yeah, those particular numbers are the most striking in the report, and I think they've been sort of highlighted in that way. I think that, yes, we were surprised to see quite that much disparity. I think as we look at the data, we need to be clear, though, that the 5% in Mattapan is particularly striking for that population because there are no Tier 1 schools near Mattapan. And so that same disparity doesn't generalize to all the other southern neighborhoods. But nonetheless, you make a very good point. It is striking.
Okay, so the same disparity doesn't generalize, but nevertheless, there was a disparity in other neighborhoods for sure, though, right?
Oh, unquestionably.
Okay, so but nevertheless, this algorithm was intended to close those gaps and to give students in some neighborhoods greater access to high quality schools. I mean, what was it supposed to do? How was it supposed to do that?
It was supposed to do that by creating what they call universal minimum access. So everyone gets access to a certain number of high-quality schools. Unfortunately, what it didn't take account of was competition for those schools. And so let's say you live in a neighborhood and you have 200 neighbors and I have 100 neighbors and we have the same number of schools in our basket, choice basket, to choose from. There's a lot more competition in the neighborhood with 200 students. And what the algorithm really failed to take into account was that level of competition that would sort of push people out of the schools they hoped they could get.
Okay. So, Kevin Murray, you're with Quality Education for Every Student, a parent group. I mean, what was your initial reaction when you saw this report?
Finally was my initial reaction. I think it's been well reported that when the algorithm, this so-called home-based system, was originally put in place, it was put in place with a condition, a proviso, that there would be an evaluation of it after the first year of operation.
Which
there
wasn't.
Just to see if, in fact, there would be some issues that needed to be resolved in any way. That was 4 years ago. Just over 3 years ago, Quest made a public records request for the data that Dan eventually got, saying that we felt like if the Boston Public Schools were not going to do this evaluation, they should make public the data so that other people could look at the data and comment on it. The public records request was not responded to. We never received the data. The first time we saw the data that came out in the report was when the report came out. So one reaction was finally. The other reaction is, I think, the extremes of the report were somewhat surprising even for us. And my reading of the report is that there are ways in which this new system has made things slightly worse or noticeably worse. Part of the report talks about the increasing segregation at the kindergarten and early grade level in certain neighborhoods of the city. This is a very concerning trend because those trends will move through the system. As those kindergartners become second, third, and fourth graders, those classes are not going to become more diverse, right? They're going to continue to be as segregated or more segregated than they were as kindergartners. So that, to me, is a real concern.
And that increasing segregation, do you think it's being driven by the use of this algorithm
exacerbated? I mean, that's my only question about what you said is that the intention was to give more access to quality schools. Really, the intention was quality schools closer to home.
Closer to home.
Home was always the idea. And just think about it. We have a city that has residential segregation, not at the level of some other cities, but residential segregation remains the order of the day in Boston. We also have a city where quality schools are not evenly distributed.
Yeah.
Strangely, not surprisingly, they follow that same pattern of segregation as housing.
Can I just jump here? Because doesn't that get then right to one of the fundamental questions, that if one of the factors which any algorithm is going to use in school assignment systems in Boston is closer to home, I think it was roughly a 1 mile radius we were talking about here, that we're never going to get past this problem.
Correct. That's never going to be a basis for an equitable assignment system. And that's been our contention throughout, not just ours. Many voices have raised the issue. And all these issues, all the problems with the system were raised in a year-long conversation. To the city's credit, they facilitated a public conversation of this process, of this proposal. And all these issues were raised during that time.
Dan O'Brien, jump in here. What do you think?
So I think this really highlights a very tough tension here, right? And two difficulties with an algorithm like this. The first one is, you know, as is being mentioned, right, the city is de facto segregated, right? So if you're going to have people going to school closer to home, you're inevitably going to start to separate by race, by socioeconomic status across schools. And I think there has to be a really serious conversation among the Boston public school community. What is the balance there? Because we also know parents do, and during the process that was spoken about in 2012, parents said, we want to go closer to home. We don't want to get bussed across the city. That's not necessarily always equivalent to quality for us. And so there's a real tension there, and it really comes down to how much can you fix with just an algorithm, and how much do you have to tailor to the needs and conversation of the community?
You know, we've got some tape here from Alexandra Oliver Davila. Sorry, excuse me, I pronounced her name incorrectly, but she's a school committee member. And on Monday night's meeting, I believe, there was a lot of discussion about this and, you know, about this question of, can we solve the problem for as long as the distribution of high-quality schools isn't what we want them to be in Boston? Here's what she said.
It's helpful, and there's some Band-Aid work, but really we're still going to be a segregated Boston. And so how can we move together as a city, as a district, and really look at all those pieces?
Kevin Murray, what do you think?
The MIT people that put together this algorithm were very clear. There is no technical barrier to creating an equitable assignment system. We can create a system in which every student, whether they're in Mattapan or the North End, has equal access to the quality seats that exist. That's a mathematical problem, and one thing MIT people and Northeastern people can do is solve those mathematical problems. The question was, is the city of Boston ready to address the political challenges, the social challenges that that implies? The implications of giving everybody that access in a city that's as segregated as Boston, with the patterns of educational delivery that we have, are significant. And there's a perception that to do that runs the risk of having certain kinds of people withdraw their children from the school. That's why this is the third rail of Boston politics.
I mean, the fear is the mid-1970s all over again.
Or something like
or
that.
That was an extreme way of putting it, but I don't think it's outlandish necessarily.
Right. But when you have an algorithm, there's a wonderful slide in Dan's in the Bari report that shows a bar graph with four bars, and it shows white and Asian families with this level of access and their indexed values. African American families have half that level of access across the city. And then Latino families are somewhere in between. If you're an African-American family in the city of Boston and you know that you start out with one half the access to a reasonable, quality seat in the school system, what's your response to that?
Mm.
Right? So, and the assumption is that families like mine are going to withdraw from the system if everybody has equal access to the good seats. That's never been tested. I know hundreds of families in Boston that would not withdraw in the face of an equitable system. There probably are some that would. But I think we need to flip this thing and call our system an equity-based school assignment system and follow that name where it takes us.
Dan O'Brien?
Yeah, so I think you raised some great points. And I think there's I think there's a second thread of the conversation. So to your main point, right, absolutely. Scholars, you know, data technicians and scientists like those at Bari and other places, we can try to build a more equitable algorithm. And we made recommendations on how to do that. But I think the other problem is, as you pointed out much earlier, right, the inequitable distribution of quality schools across the geography of the city, right? If people would like to go to school closer to home and they're making a trade-off there, giving them access to a great school that's 2 miles away might not be attractive.
But I feel like the ideal that many parents have rightly been calling for years and years and years is exactly that, more quality schools closer to home.
Exactly. And I think maybe what I'm saying is that we need to be having those two conversations simultaneously rather than just arguing about the policy on the one end and the quality on the other end. They go hand in hand.
Kevin Murray, just got a couple seconds here.
I agree with that, but we need an assignment system that's equitable for the school system that we have right now. Right. There's going to be a transition period. Quest is 100% behind the idea that the only solution for Boston is more quality schools in all neighborhoods. In the meantime, we need an equitable assignment system, not an affirmative action system, an affirmative action program for white and Asian families, which I think this report shows that the current assignment system is exactly that.
Well, Kevin Murray is a parent with the parent organization, Quality Education for Every Student, or Quest. Thank you so much for joining us. And Dan O'Brien, Associate Professor at Northeastern University and Co-Director of the Boston Area Research Initiative. Thank you as well.
My pleasure. Thank you, Magna.
All right, so let's pick up another quick story about Boston Public Schools, because we now know the terms of former Boston Public School Superintendent Tommy Chang's departure. Chang will receive around $300,000, up to a year of health insurance, and a letter of recommendation in exchange for stepping down from his position last month. The deal was approved by the school committee behind closed doors, and that may be a violation of the state's open meeting law. The terms of the deal were only discovered after Commonwealth Magazine filed a public records request. And joining us now with more is WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin. Hello, Max.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, first of all, let's start off with the deal that Chang is receiving. It sounds like actually they're pretty standard terms.
They are pretty standard. You know, Meghna, that superintendents don't tend to last very long in their jobs, especially not in big city districts, about 3-ish years on average. So school committees typically reserve the authority to terminate those superintendents without cause. And that's why Glenn Kuchar, who runs the state's association on school committees, he says these payouts have become really common in Massachusetts and elsewhere. Let's listen.
Looks like we don't have that tape here, but Glenn Kuchar is saying it helps.
He says, in effect, yeah, you can lose your job any minute as a superintendent, but that you have this assurance that on your way out the door, you will get a payout like the one Tommy Chang got. Indeed, this one was part of Chang's contract, 12 months of his base salary. In other cities, Fort Worth, Howard County, Maryland, outgoing superintendents have actually gotten a lot more, $900,000, $1 million or more in exchange for early departures.
Okay. Max, I should let you know that we have some technological gremlins here today in the studio, so we don't have any of the sound that you have so diligently gathered for us. I'm sorry about that, but we have you, which is the most important thing. So to your point about the school committee, of course, having the power to hire and fire superintendents as necessary, what's the legal issue then behind the terms of this departure?
Yeah, I mean, arguably, this is the biggest part of a school committee's job is hiring and firing a superintendent. And they had decided that Chang was entitled to this payout under his contract. But the problem is the school committee didn't vote on the terms of his termination in a public meeting. Instead, they agreed to it in so-called executive session, closed to the public. The minutes for that meeting haven't been approved yet. We don't know quite what was said. But the state's open meeting law says that public bodies can hash out personnel decisions in private. They do have to come back to the open session and take a final vote.
Okay, so have we heard anything from the school committee about this or the process?
They are keeping pretty quiet for now. It seems as if a complaint has been filed, but they did release a statement saying that the committee, quote, vetted this matter carefully with the office of the legal advisor, namely their lawyers, and the lawyers determined that this matter, quote, did not involve the hiring, terminating, or reviewing of a superintendent, nor involve the approval of a policy or a budget. So this is not a termination, and as such, they felt they could do it in an executive session.
Okay. To be honest, that sounds like legalese, which makes me wonder about the Attorney General's office. Has the AG's office ever handled a case like this before?
Meghna, they have. A lot of these complaints come in. Back in 2016, the Attorney General's office looked at a very similar process in Amherst Pelham. That's a regional school district out west. And they found that they violated the open meeting law by deliberating over email and failing to make disclosures about what they had said in executive session. Same thing being negotiated, a separation agreement. So at the end of that finding, they ordered compliance and they warned Amherst Pelham against further violations.
Any reaction from the community?
Yeah, this, I think, part of what I'm thinking of is the segment we just heard. This has been a turbulent month for the district. Tommy Chang left without a public hearing. The city's charter says that's required. We have a new interim superintendent who has a lot of support. But Laura Peril, she took over on a super accelerated timeline, and that left some parents upset. And then you have people who represent this majority-minority district who feel like parents are being left out of this process. They say, why don't we have faith, including some people at the NAACP, why don't we have faith in these parents and their ability to handle input into these difficult decisions?
Well, that's WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin. Max, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
All right, we'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And ladies and gentlemen, today's one of those days where technical difficulties are defining this show. So bear with me, because I was going to play for you a pretty sizzling remark from Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. You may have heard it. It was the one that was released by Recode Decode, the podcast hosted by Kara Swisher. The one from earlier this week where Mark Zuckerberg basically said, here, I'm going to quote. I can't really do a Mark Zuckerberg impression, but here's my quote. Zuckerberg said, there's a set of people who deny that the Holocaust happened. I find that deeply offensive. But at the end of the day, I don't believe that our platform should take that down because I think there are things that different people get wrong. I don't think that they're intentionally getting it wrong. Wow, it's hard to impugn intent, Mark Zuckerberg said. Well, obviously, enormous criticism followed, and then Zuckerberg, in an email to Swisher, added that, quote, he didn't intend to defend the intent of Holocaust deniers. But finally, with incisive moral clarity, the Anti-Defamation League cut through that confusion and simply said that Facebook has a moral and ethical obligation not to publish lies about the Holocaust. So this brings up all sorts of questions about Facebook being a censor of speech and whether or not that's right. So Hiawatha Bray, writer for the Tech Lab at the Boston Globe, has been following the story. And Hiawatha, I'm keeping my fingers crossed that our line to you is working. Are you there?
Oh, yeah. So good.
You're there on a phone, though? Oh, my gosh. I'm telling you, today's technical difficulties. Please stand by. All right. Hiawatha, what do you make about what Zuckerberg said about Holocaust deniers?
I am not necessarily inclined to feel sorry for Jeff Zuckerberg, but I really feel for
Mark Zuckerberg, yeah.
Mark Zuckerberg. Did I say Jeff?
Yeah.
I did, didn't I?
Getting your billionaires confused.
I'm getting all of my mega billionaires confused today. I do find myself feeling sympathy for him because what he is up against is the problem that arose early on in the rise of social media and the internet, where the question is, if you're the company that publishes what other people are saying online, to what extent are you responsible for picking and choosing what they're allowed to say?
Yeah.
One of the key things that one of the Magna Carta, you might almost say, of the internet as we know it, was this part. It was ironically the Communications Decency Act, but there is a provision of it called Section 230, which liberated so much of the internet as we now know it. And what it basically said was, if you run an internet forum, such as Facebook, where other people are publishing information, you cannot be held responsible for what other people say on your forum.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some exceptions for this, but as a general rule, if you publish something on Facebook, Facebook isn't officially responsible for what you're doing there, because it is treated as an open forum as opposed to like some kind of an editorial product, like I guess a newspaper or
but
a magazine.
This is in
like
the
that.
United States, though, you're talking about.
Yeah, this is just in the United States.
I want to jump in here. Yeah.
See things very different.
So, Hiawatha, I want to jump in here because Facebook is a global company, as
exactly.
We know. And I'm seeing here that last year, in 2017, The Guardian actually got a hold of a slide deck that Facebook gave out to moderators that work for Facebook about what to do regarding Holocaust denial that showed up in Facebook posts. And there's a slide there that says they have a geo-blocking policy that they say Holocaust denial is illegal in 14 countries, okay?
Right.
But Facebook will only geo-block the content if it's reported from four countries, France, Germany, Israel, and Austria. And you know why? Because those are the four countries that would go after Facebook.
Ah, that makes sense, because they would. They absolutely would. But I get what they're worried about. And I mean, because the flip side of this argument, and we have seen this going on and on and on, are the claims that Facebook, here in the United States, is censoring people simply because they hold controversial views. Now, it's easy to denounce Holocaust denial, but as I'm sure you know, people have actually chosen the term climate denial to describe people who do not accept the most, hardcore views about climate change, believing that it is a crisis that demands immediate government action and so forth. People who say, oh, it's not that big deal, or even there's no such thing, are called climate deniers, and there are actually people who have argued that they should not even be given the time. Al Gore, former vice president of the United States, has said that newspapers should not even interview people who take that point of view. So, does Jeff Zuckerberg running Jeff?
Mark.
I keep saying Jeff. Mark Zuckerberg go up to the people who are in charge of deciding what goes on Facebook and say, from here on out, if anybody posts a message that denies climate change, kick them off.
But they are making decisions, though. I mean, Zuckerberg, in that same interview with Kara Swisher, said that they are going to start removing content if it's abusive towards individuals, whether or not it's a threat.
Yeah.
I mean, that goes beyond current speech laws.
Well, yeah, I mean, you got to understand, I work for a newspaper. You work for a radio station. We'd have done things like that all along. We routinely say, we're not printing that. It's not considered outrageous for us to do that kind of thing in our business. It's very different from an internet forum. They haven't figured out how to do it. Nobody else has either. And it's very difficult and very dangerous to figure out exactly where to draw the line. There's stuff where everybody, I mean, this is a classic example. I'm sorry. To me, this is an easy one. Holocaust denial, goodbye. But how close to the line do you want to get? Do we start having these guys pull every highly controversial thing off of Facebook? Suppose somebody writes an essay in defense of the good character of Robert E. Lee. There are people who are convinced.
Well, but so what? I guess my point is that Facebook is by step making these decisions, and the only way to take the power out of their hands is for governments to step in.
Are you kidding? What a nightmare! That's 1,000 times worse.
Well, Hiawatha Bray reports on technology and writes for the Tech Lab at the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, thank you as always.
Oh, thank you.
Well, that's it for today. Thanks, everyone, for your patience. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.